It's amazing. It's really amazing. On several occasions, I have had people talk to me about the alcoholism problem in a friend or a relative. And somewhere in the conversation, they'll say, hey, by the way, Father, I'm not an alcoholic. And I want to say, what's that got to do with it? I'm not a leper, but I don't feel obligated to tell people. I'm not 5,000 years old. I'm not bald. I don't feel an obligation to say that. But it's like waving a flag.
Oh, yes, it's one of my favorite charities.
But I'm not one. I'm not one. I really want it known that even though I can talk freely about it, I don't have this horrible thing. Attitudes, attitudes, attitudes. Well, what are some of the signs? Let's have a very brief little educational session here. What are some of the signs of this disease? How can I spot it? Now, my friends, anybody on earth can spot alcoholism in a former corporation lawyer who is now bumming nickels. A two-year-old can diagnose him now that he's at the end of the line. I wonder how many of us could have spotted his alcoholism, let's say, 18 years ago when he was at the top of his profession, when he was wearing $500 silk suits, when he still had his mansion and his family and his cars. But there were symptoms there that were as readable as a book. What are some of these symptoms? I think one of the first is one that is very rarely mentioned, and that's this. When one's drinking becomes the topic of serious conversation on the part of people who are concerned about it, they are talking about alcoholism. My friends, nobody discusses non-problems. If you and your wife, or you and your husband, and three or four other couples have ever sat around on a Saturday afternoon at a cookout seriously discussing somebody's drinking, because you're concerned about it, that is the classic textbook case where there is smoke, there is fire. You are not talking about a non-problem. Number two, lying about drinking. We speak of unnatural acts in the realm of sexuality. They pale into insignificance when compared with the lie. A lie is the prostitution of the mind, which is made for truth. When your drinking makes you lie about your drinking, you've got a drinking problem. When your drinking, in other words, makes you perform unnatural acts, something is wrong. I ask one question to diagnose the disease. I know it's simplistic. There may be rare exceptions. I've never experienced any. Do normal drinkers do this? If your answer is no, you're talking about abnormal drinkers. Do normal drinkers lie about their drinking? Answer, they have absolutely no reason to. They have absolutely no reason to. None. Take a normal drinker. He gets on an elevator, and it's just about 11:30 in the morning, and he reeks of booze. He gives a sigh, and everybody in the elevator kind of holds the nose a bit. And a friend of his standing beside him says, good heavens, Jim, have you been drinking? He says, yes, I just came from wedding reception. Why do you ask? He has nothing to hide. Take an alcoholic who gets on an elevator in the morning, a morning on which he has been drinking. He'll hold his breath for 90 floors so you won't smell it. Old Blue, he's called. Do you see what I'm after? The obvious becomes so obvious when somebody hits us with it. Gulping and sneaking drinks. I have said this so many, many times. If any of you men were to go home tonight and see your wife sneak out of the dining room into the bathroom, open the toilet tank, pull out a quart of milk, and drink three shots, you'd have her committed in about 2 minutes with absolutely no questions asked. And yet a lot of people drink alcohol that way. That's called gulping and sneaking them. And we kind of half think it's cute. It's just not normal. Normal drinkers don't do that. Do you know any normal eaters who go into a closet to eat a candy bar? Now, I know some abnormal eaters who do, literally. But normal people don't do that. And then for those of you who work in an office situation, there's a man or woman there who has to go to the bathroom 8, 9, 10 times before lunch. Everybody knows why. Everybody in the building knows why. Hungover, desperately in need of a drink, but you do not drink at your desk. So here's this girl. She picks up the purse in which she has the half pint of vodka, and she heads for the John. You want to know something about attitudes? Watch the rest of us. You know what we do? We wink at each other, we nudge elbows, and we grin. Woman has a terminal disease, isn't that funny? She's going into that toilet to survive. All you have to do is ask your question, do normal drinkers drink in the lavatory? Usually not. So you see what I'm after. The basic definition of alcoholism rests on a truism. It's in the world of philosophy, there are, I believe, five what they call self-evident truths. You can't prove them. They're self-evident. One of them is called the principle of negation. A thing cannot, at the same time, both exist and not exist. Either it is or it isn't. There isn't a soul on earth can prove that. You either see it or you don't. There's another, what I call a self-evident truth. What makes trouble is trouble. Because it makes trouble. Now, you either see that or you don't. There's a hole in the sidewalk in the front of a man's house. And in the last 3 years, he has tripped and busted his leg 6 times in that hole. I humbly submit, for your serious intellectual consideration, the hole is trouble because it causes trouble. Now, you can sit on your porch with your leg in a cast, intellectualizing about causes, but if you don't fill the hole up, you're probably going to break your leg again. And a 5-year-old knows that. An intellectual will sit up there with both legs in casts. Now listen to him. He is smart.
I know why that hole is there. This is a rainy area of the country. The soil here is very porous. And when the rain hits the soil, it becomes very heavy and soggy. And after a while, in this area right here, the soil eroded and kind of was swept away, and the asphalt followed, and that's why there's a hole there. Brilliant and perfectly true till a little kid rides by on a bicycle, pumping it with 2 good legs, and he says, "Dummy, fill up the hole or you'll break your leg again." When alcohol makes trouble, that's called alcohol trouble.
You want to know what an alcoholic is? Ask a kid. Kids don't just say things like, "Well, the weekend is coming. I hate to be home. I just hate to be around them." Or this spine chiller. "I don't bring kids home from school anymore." Kids don't just say that. They get right to the heart of the matter. They'll tell you exactly why they don't want to be around home anymore and why they don't bring friends around. "My father drinks too much." Bam! He just hit the problem right in the nose. So we recognize drinking problems when we see problems that are caused by drinking. That's what alcoholism is. The paradox of it all. If you were to go home to discover that your little daughter has multiple sclerosis, you'd have a doctor on the phone in less than a minute. You can live with an alcoholic for 15 years and never bother to read a syllable about it. Attitudes. They're beauties. I have a sister who is the mother of a dwarf. He was born early in the morning, and it was very obvious that he had this dwarfism. At 9 a.m., when the library, about 3 blocks from the hospital, opened up, one of my brothers was waiting to go into the medical section to read what was available on dwarfism. We do that for every disease except alcoholism. until through sheer agony and pain we are forced to. Attitudes. This is the most emotional disease on earth. Cancer, uremic poisoning, people who have suffered amputation. Name any malady that can strike the human being, it almost pales into insignificance compared with alcoholism and the attitudes that cling to it. Number three, alcoholism is addiction and it needs proper therapy. Willpower has nothing to do with it. The underlying principle is obvious. It's a disease and you're not about to get over it until you have proper therapy. Willpower has precious little to do with it. The only thing the will can do is to say, yes, I will respond to this treatment, whatever it is. There are five basic addictions: narcotics, alcohol, food, gambling, and work. And the only one that is faintly humorous is the work addict, especially the compulsive cleaner. Have you ever been in a home where the hostess will empty the ashtray beside you 22 times in an evening and you don't smoke? See, that's called compulsion. That's it. All right. Non-addicts find it virtually impossible to understand addiction. But I'm going to ask all of you to believe this. If there's anyone who believes that alcoholism is a question of willpower, doesn't this make sense? If it were a question of willpower, there wouldn't be any alcoholics. No one in his right mind chooses to die the excruciating death of alcoholism, or to subject himself to the possibility of being killed on a highway or choking on his own vomit, as many do. Let's all take a tiny little test. Go back to age 10. You're 10 years old. You're in about, what, third or fourth or fifth grade? Mentally, write on a slip of paper what you want to be when you grow up. How many of you wrote drunk? How many of you wrote alcoholic? Nobody. No one chooses to be an alcoholic. For those of you who do believe that it is a question of willpower, the closest thing I can come to it is this. Have you ever tried willpower with diarrhea or a toothache or cancer? Just doesn't work. What's the conclusion? You can arrest addiction, provided you have proper therapy. Willpower just isn't enough. Proper therapy. And we'll get to that in a minute. Number four, the first hint, I have a proper attitude. I see he's sick. I want to help him to get well. Number two, I have learned enough about the disease to see that this so-and-so here, my brother, my father, my friend, has it. Number three, he can't get well without proper therapy. Number four, what do I do? Confront the alcoholic with the fact of his problem. Not stopping there, but suggesting what he might do to alleviate his problem. Ladies and gentlemen, don't just tell me I've got something wrong with me and stop there. Because if you do, I will learn several things about you. You're moralizing and you're condescending. And then you're going to learn something about me. I won't be listening to you. What is a proper confrontation? Something done by the right person at the right time with the right words in the right place. What are they? I don't know. If I knew, I could save the world. A proper confrontation says, in effect, you're going to have to use the right words, whatever they might be, depending on the person you're talking to. You have a drinking problem, comma, and I know where you can get help, comma, and I will take you there, period. That, to me, is a proper confrontation. Who does it best? Someone in authority. I'll never forget, as long as I live, I was down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I had given this particular talk, and a young boy, 15, had a very somber look on his face, came up to me afterwards. He said, how do you force someone into treatment that you don't have authority over? In fact, he has authority over you. I said, is it your dad? He said, yes. And he's also president of his own company. That kid may just as well put handcuffs on me. I felt that useless. I said, son, you may have to watch your father die because there's nobody above him who can order him into treatment. But I said, don't quit praying for him. And the boy said, thank you, and walked away. And I just wanted to run after him and pull him back and do something to help him. But what are the right words? I don't know. What works today might not work yesterday, and what might have worked yesterday won't work today. I know a man whose life was saved by his son. He came home one night, and his boy said three words to him. He said, Dad, you stink. And that man had been fooling around for 14 years, in and out of treatment and in and out of AA, but he wanted his son's love more, and he wanted to be drunk. So he got serious, and he got sober. You know, the underlying principle here is that the best time to get an alcoholic is when he's in pain. The principle being, when you hurt bad enough to want to quit hurting, you will then do something to stop the pain. I've told many a group before that the American toilet seat, you know, the one with the opening in the front, looks like a horseshoe, that was invented by an alcoholic who got tired of getting hit in the back of the neck with the old model. When you hurt bad enough to want to quit hurting, you will do something to stop the pain. And it is my passionate belief that the greatest gift that God can give the alcoholic is the gift of pain. And the most exquisite pain is that of self-hatred. When an alcoholic is given the grace of waking up in the morning, looking at his image in a mirror, and experiencing an overwhelming desire to vomit because he just can't stomach what he's looking at, that's a great blessing. Because then he may be motivated to want to change all that. What is the best time to approach an alcoholic? Well, if he's sober, he'll reason circles around you. Why are you drinking? He'll give you enough reasons. After 2 minutes, you'll say, wait, I'll get my hat and go with you. When he's drunk, it's like talking to anybody, drugged. The best time to get the alcoholic, theoretically, in general, is when he is in pain, because that's when he is most vulnerable, usually the morning after the night before. Here is where a wise wife, educated in the ways of Al-Anon, and I'll speak of that later, on any given morning when he is so hungover that he can't make it into work, she calls the boss and says, come here and see it. This is why he's not in work. He's hungover. He's too drunk to move. It is then that he is most vulnerable and may say, okay, whatever you say. The fifth, pardon the expression, the fifth hint is to make the alcoholic responsible for his behavior. Now, my friends, I am not talking about moral responsibility. I'm talking about legal liability. It's not guilt, it's consequence. For example, here's a young man who hits a baseball. He's out in his backyard smacking baseballs. And the wind, it's in the springtime, and one of these lovely March winds grabs the ball and puts it through a neighbor's window. So he didn't intend that, but he feels a little bit guilty. So he goes next door and he says, Miss Smith, I hit that ball, and I'm the one who broke your window. I'm sorry. She says, I forgive you. That'll be $12.98. You pay for the glass. Same way with the alcoholic. Make the alcoholic responsible for his behavior. What I mean is this, if he winds up in jail for a weekend, you don't hock your eye teeth to bail him out. Every single time a wife makes good a bad check, she just gave him permission to write the next one. Now, this is the last time. It's the 8,000th time she has said this is the last time. The alcoholic's instinct knows how to play people like a violin. What's the underlying principle? Obvious. Every time you pick up the tab for the alcoholic, you just bought him his next drunk. And it doesn't make sense to aid and abet someone on the way to the grave. Just doesn't make sense. And yet the emotion is so deeply involved in this, that this is the paradox of this disease. Those who love us most contribute to our downfall and destruction by doing the very things, motivated only by love, the very things that will destroy us. The next hint, alcoholism is a family disease. Families need treatment. I don't know how alcoholism is passed on, but it is. Most alcoholics come from an alcoholic background. And every one of them said, it won't happen to me. I'm not going to drink the way my father does. I'm not going to drink the way my mother does. I'm not going to drink the way my brother or my sister does, whatever. And yet their attitudes toward the substance have been so messed up that they can't handle it when they try. Why? I don't know. I know a man who was sober many, many years. Some years ago, his son came into the program, and a few years after that, one after another, his three children came into the program. I've seen this generation after generation producing alcoholics. It is said that the sickest of the sick is the alcoholic because he is the last to acknowledge that he is sick. Well, there's one person sicker, and that's the person who lives with the alcoholic, because in the non-alcoholic's mind, the alcoholic has the problem. It's the bottle. I'm the strong one. I know a young wife who was so beaten down by her alcoholic husband. Every time he drank, he used sarcasm. He used his intellectual superiority. He used everything to grind her into the ground. That woman used to hang her clothes. She used to wash her clothes and hang them in the yard on the line at 2 a.m. in the dark so no one could see her. I mean, that is true. She simply could not stand to have other people just look at her. She felt so bad, so dirty, such a failure. He blamed her for his drinking. How sick can you get? Sickness feeding on sickness. So the whole family needs treatment. Number 7, you therefore use all the alcoholism resources at your command. It is so sad to see people in AA say things like, well, he or she is my pigeon. It's almost an impression that is created. I am responsible for this person's sobriety. Oh, even though they say, you know, no, but the impression given is, this is my pigeon. Or medical people saying, this is my patient. Look, alcoholism is a very complete disease, body, mind, emotion, and soul. It's going to take a whole network of people, a whole network of people to get them well. Now, one person, obviously, will be the main person in your sobriety. For example, a surgeon, he's the main person responsible for getting you over whatever problem you had inside your body. But please remember, he had a whole crew helping him, a whole crew in the operating room and afterwards. Every one of whom contributed. We have AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, primarily for therapy for the alcoholic. We have Al-Anon, which is a sister discipline for non-alcoholics, where they may band together and share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. We have Al-Ateen, where youngsters can gather and share the pain in their young, lonely hearts with each other. In fact, in some areas, I think they have Al-A-Tot, and somebody's going to come along someday with Al-A-Wet for little teeny-weeny babies of alcoholics. Well, anyway, there are local councils on alcoholism, and there are treatment centers. I believe the last I read or heard somewhere, there are over 4,000 treatment centers in the United States. So there's all kinds of help available. Use them all. Use them all. And the last hint is for the helper. Never give up hope, never. I had a man call me quite recently. He said, my wife is a hopeless alcoholic. Well, I don't believe that. Uh, When an alcoholic admits his own helplessness, he ceases to be hopeless. Now there's hope. But don't ever be discouraged, even when an alcoholic dies of alcoholism. I remember one time I was leaving the base theater at McGuire Air Force Base, and a sergeant, a master sergeant, who happened also to be a Baptist minister. He was not, obviously, not in the chaplain's corps. He was a master sergeant. And he came up to me. He had a beautiful face, just a lovely smile. And he said, you know, my term in the service will be up soon. I'll have 20 years. He said, I'm going to retire and go back to the little southern town where I was born and raised and dedicate my life to alcoholics. And he belonged to a religious denomination that disapproves the use of alcohol. I said, that's rather strange for you. How come? Well, he said, my father and my brother both died alcoholic deaths. And I could almost see his mind saying their lives were wasted, and somehow or other, I'm going to make up for it so that God might be merciful to them. Now, he didn't say this, but I'm you know, it was all there. And I said, Lee, some people are asked to die of a lot of different diseases. Some people are killed in accidents. Some die of cancer. Some die of this, some die of that. And alcoholism is a disease, and some people will die of that. I said, I cannot prove this, but I believe it. I really believe it. No alcoholic who dies drunk dies in vain. The alcoholic who dies drunk was asked by God to carry his disease to the grave, and he gets sobriety after this life. I also believe this, that by having to carry that cross to the grave, they somehow or other, before the throne of God, they have helped to buy sobriety for those of us who have gotten sober during this life. I said, now, as I said before, I can't prove that. But if I did not believe it, then there is no such thing as the brotherhood of man. And he lit up like a Christmas tree. He said, I never thought of that. I said, I wish you would. Here's another thought about those who die drunk. There's a man who's very prominent in AA. I have never had the privilege of hearing him speak personally, but I have heard of him for a lot of years. And he has helped a lot of people. He's a very, very powerful, powerful speaker. And he has indeed helped a lot of people. But always in his talk, he would refer to a brother whom he was simply unable to help. And sure enough, his brother died of his alcoholism. You know what that man says now when he speaks? He comes to the end of his talk and he says, by the way, my brother Billy, he doesn't drink anymore. What a way to look at it. Beautiful, beautiful. But I know this. You cannot appreciate water till the well runs dry, and it is only when you have worked with drunks who have died or who have simply not made it that you can begin to appreciate it when you have been chosen to be the instrument of one who does make it. Bishop Sheen used to say, you have no Easter Sunday without a Good Friday. To live is to hurt, and there's a lot of pain in it. Alcoholism is a field in which there is great pain and discouragement for those who work in it, but conversely, there is the greatest gratification and happiness in it. Once you have had your hand in helping to save another human life, you're hooked. I believe that every single human being has the ability before he dies to be instrumental somehow in the saving of another human life. I can't prove that either, but I believe it. And once you've done that, you're hooked. You're just hooked. I have often said that alcoholics are far more addictive than alcohol. So if ever you've been discouraged, put the discouragement in your pocket and grasp hope. Grasp hope. We can't survive without hope. And so, I do not wish you joy without a sorrow. nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom, goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. Thank you, and good evening.